Welcome to Phantom Island, presented by Homefield. Today, you are getting me, Ryan Nanny, hosting an edition of Numbers and Words, but it's not about college football, at least not predominantly. Joining me with the numbers part of the show is Neil Payne, who I worked with during the brief existence of The Messenger and enjoyed collaborating with on all kinds of topics from actual football discussion to the Ted Cruz sports curse. Neil has a Substack you can check out at Neil Payne, that's neilpaine.substack.com, and he also does some writing for ESPN and NASCAR, and he hosts a NASCAR podcast called Pod Racing. You should check him out. He's much smarter than I am, and he's a lot of fun to chat with. Okay, here's me and Neil. Neil, I want to start by talking about the recently fired Tom Thibodeau. This is a guy who had a better record with the Knicks than the last three guys they had given the main job to. He was the first Knicks coach since Jeff Van Gundy to make it to the playoffs three straight years. He was the first Knicks coach since Pat Riley to win 50 games in consecutive seasons. We are recording this as the news of his successor, Mike Brown, is like still pretty fresh. And I think the thing that sticks out to me, or sort of the thing that made me say, like, hey, I'm going to call my old buddy Neil and make him sort of like wrestle with this with me, is how does this work? Like, how, you know, I understand what the Knicks are trying to do, but this is not the first team that has looked at a coach and said, like, yep, you got super far in the playoffs, but we think we can do better. And I guess I want to start from the general premise of, like, how often does this bet work, and is there anything you can point to sort of say, like, when it works, it's because a team does X or Y?
Yeah, and that's kind of the question that's going to hang over the Knicks certainly all summer and into Mike Brown's tenure there. And to try to kind of frame it, what I did was I looked back at the big four pro leagues, so NBA, MLB, NFL, NHL. And I tried as best I could to find situations where both a coach had taken a team to the Final Four, however you define that, conference finals or, you know, AFC, NFC championship game, that type of thing, in that sport. And then they were fired. And my definition of fired really kind of depended on looking at and reading the tea leaves around the news or the way it was described in their departure. Mm-hmm. Some guys were just outright fired. Some, their contracts were allowed to expire. Some asked, especially this was the case in some of these old-timey baseball seasons, where they would ask for a multi-year extension, and that was considered such an affront to the ownership that they decided, they're like, no.
How dare you want to be rewarded for your success?
Exactly. Yeah, we do one-year contracts here. Mm-hmm. There was the Dodgers were an example of that, where they had a manager that they fired, and then the following manager coached on. He was the one that asked for the multi-year, Chuck Dressen was his name, mm-hmm. asked for the multi-year extension after 3 years, and they lost the World Series, but they were a contending team, and the Dodgers said no, and then Walter Alston, his replacement, signed 23 consecutive one-year contracts, and in that span, it's on his Wikipedia page, actually, and they won four World Series, so that's a case of actually it did work out for them. We were sort of, if those of us who were thinking, like, yeah, good for you, Chuck Dressen, you know, maybe rooting for that not to work out for the Dodgers, unfortunately, it did work out, and they were able to get their championships with the replacement. But anyway, so your mileage could kind of vary. Phil Jackson had a number of ones where, was he fired? Did he retire? Was it mutual? A lot of those. But when I erred on the side of firing, just because, like, I wanted it to be a more interesting list. And also, these guys, like, your default should be to bring these guys back, right? I mean, they've just made the Final Four.
I think that tends to be a more honest assessment. Like, when you hear, like, mutually parted ways or, like, this guy stepped down. There are examples of coaches who got fed up or sort of were like, I don't want to work with management or I have a new opportunity. So I'm not saying it never happens, but I do think, like, erring on the side of you got fired, but we decided not to use that word is probably the more accurate way to go.
I think that's right. Yeah. And so when I did that, I was able to find 46 cases of these coaching changes that were directly due to fired, whether explicitly or implicitly fired, which made up of the whole list that I had was 102 coaches. So it's actually kind of rare for a coach to leave directly after going to the Final Four or the championship or winning the championship in general. Mm-hmm. But of those, 45% were fired. And then the next most common causes were at 17% apiece, took another job or retired, which makes sense as well. Yeah. And then you have a few were due to illnesses. One guy died, which was pretty tragic with the Pittsburgh Penguins in 1991. Their coach passed away right after leading them to the championship. But by far, the most common reason was firing. And so what I did was I wanted to see it, when we're measuring how it works, whether it works, and the Knicks, I think their benchmark for whether it works will probably be, can Mike Brown take them back to a conference final and ideally further, but certainly at a bare minimum, get us to where Tibbs had us is the sort of, I think, the way that this will be judged. And if you look at how often that happened overall in the whole sample of coaches, 44% of the replacements brought the team back to the Final Four, which was higher than I was expecting, actually. And I'm not sure necessarily what our baseline should be for just any team, regardless of whether they fire the coach or not, who just made a Final Four appearance. Should we expect them to get back 40% of the time? I mean, I guess maybe that feels right. You're working with a team that clearly has the talent to make a deep playoff run. On the other hand, there's probably a fair amount of dysfunction there just based on the fact that you did just fire the coach after that. So 44% of them did make it back. And it varied a lot by sport, which I found interesting. So in MLB, 57% of these replacement managers brought their team back to the ALCS or NLCS. Series.
Yeah.
Right. Then you have a lot of real interesting success stories. I mentioned Walter Alston with his four World Series, but Ralph Houk, who replaced Casey Stengel, who they basically were just like, you're too old, you're fired. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here with the Yankees. Ralph Houk won two World Series. You have Terry Francona, famously Grady Little was fired because he left Pedro Martinez in too long in Game 7 of the 2003 ALCS. Well, Terry Francona comes in and wins two World Series as his replacement. Even the often maligned Aaron Boone counts as a success for the Yankees after Joe Girardi because technically he got them to a World Series last year, whereas Joe Girardi could only get them to the ALCS. So those are examples in baseball where I don't know if this falls into my longstanding kind of argument or belief that baseball managers kind of like, despite the appearance of doing a lot of stuff, don't matter that much that you could just kind of fire them and bring in a replacement and immediately go back to the Final Four. But then you look at the NBA and it only works 38% of the time in terms of returning to the Final Four in basketball. Or including the ABA, like I said, they're in there too. So you have a shout out to the Pittsburgh Pipers in the 1968. Red Auerbach, by the way, he got fired after going to the BAA Finals, which was the precursor to the NBA in 1949. Yeah. The Washington Capitals fired Red Auerbach. His replacement did not make it back and only lasted 1 year, and the rest is history with Red. But that was the exception, or that was the rule to the overall exception, which is the cases like Thibodeau, it doesn't work out. And then in the NFL, it really didn't happen all that often, which was maybe the bigger surprise to me. We haven't had a situation like that since Bill Parcells and the 1996 Patriots, where he was not allowed to shop for the groceries, even though he was the chef, as he famously said. And so he left the Patriots. But that one only works out 42% of the time. And then just to round it off in the NHL, it happens only 36% of the time in which you fire the coach and then get back to the conference championships or later. And the most recent there in hockey was, I counted Barry Trotz after winning the cup with the Capitals in 2018, couldn't come to a contract extension agreement with Washington. They let him go. His replacement, Todd Reirden, peaked in the first round and only lasted two seasons, didn't make it back.
We have a hockey one that's in process, actually, too, with the Dallas Stars and Pete DeBoer,
yes,
who just got fired after. This is one where it's sort of like, it's not exactly a Tibbs situation because, yes, got fired after losing the Western Conference Final, but it's the third in a row that they did that. We can put for another conversation, like, do you fire the guy who keeps getting you to the Western to a conference final, but not beyond? Or is that somehow like more frustrating when you have a team that can keep getting one round away from playing for the cup, but can't get over the, but that's sort of a separate thing. I want to talk about the NFL side of this. I know we sort of framed this around Tibbs, and what's interesting about the NFL is that I think a lot of the names that we sort of like think about as like, oh, this is the guy they pushed out because he couldn't quite get over the hump, they don't follow this pattern. And this is like, we're shamelessly going to remember some guys here. I'm going to start because I'm from Tampa and because I remember it well with Tony Dungy. Tony Dungy obviously gets fired the very next year under John Gruden in 2002. Tampa Bay wins the Super Bowl, their first Super Bowl. That said, Tony Dungy was not consistently getting them to, and hadn't just gotten them to, an NFC championship game. He couldn't, in his last 2 years, he couldn't get them past the wild card round. In his final season, he went 9-7. The interesting thing is, Tampa, after that, they win the 0-2 Super Bowl, and then it just completely falls apart to the point where they didn't win a playoff game for nearly 20 years after that Super Bowl. And my fun fact, despite the fact that he coached one full season more than Tony Dungy did, John Gruden only has 3 more wins in Tampa than Tony Dungy does. Andy Reid's another good example in Philly. You sort of think like, oh, you know, all these times they made a Super Bowl under Andy Reid. They made a bunch of NFC championship games. He got fired after 4 years where they hadn't won a playoff game, went 8-8 and 4-12 in his last two seasons. Lovie Smith with the Bears made the NFC Championship game in 2010, but then he went 8-8 and 10-6 and missed the playoffs and got fired. Now, that said, I think with a lot of these teams, there is the sense of like, I wonder if part of why we haven't seen it very often in the NFL is there is maybe a greater awareness that like, this is not the move to make. If you have a coach who can get you into the playoffs, win at least, you know, get you at least to the conference championship round, things are probably good, and you probably shouldn't just blow that up at this point.
I think that's right. Yeah. And I think maybe that goes back to what we're talking about, the distinctions between how much a coach is perceived to sort of be responsible for those runs in different sports. Whereas in baseball, it is very kind of top down, like the GM, especially now. Yes. And I think Grady Little is like a really interesting kind of early example of that, because he was always viewed as this sort of like placeholder. You know, he's a manager, but he's really just the conduit for Theo Epstein and the brain trust that's trying to win this championship. And so when he ignores them, when they tell him this reams of data that says, hey, Pedro on like pitch 101 really starts to lose effectiveness.
Yeah.
And then he ignores that, leaves him in, and things kind of fall apart from there, that it's seen as sort of a unforgivable sin in baseball, because you ignored the real people that make the decisions. Whereas in football, the head coach is such a more powerful figure in the organization. They often talk about them as the CEO or whatever of the team, not the general manager. And oftentimes it's maybe a partnership. And we can get into so much of this also depends, and I didn't even track this, it would have been way beyond the scope of what we're doing, but like, were you hired by the current GM? Because that seems to be the biggest predictor of whether you get fired or not overall, just in coaching in general. But I think in the NFL, because the coach has so much more power in general, they're able to claim more credit when the team does go to the conference championship, and therefore they're more difficult to fire. And it buys you a lot more, like those examples that you brought up just then. One of those runs, even if it's preceded by years of not really doing anything, and even followed by years of not doing anything, it buys you more job security than you would get in other sports. I think hockey, like famously, they churn through. I mean, they really probably could just fire the coach every 3 years, regardless of what happens, just to like keep things churning, and it wouldn't make any
difference. They should go back to the old Dodgers style of just saying, you're just on a one-year contract, and we're just going to see what happens after
after every season, they should just put every coach's name in a hat and then just reassign them to every team. Because it feels like they do that anyway. It's like the same, you know, 30 guys, 32 guys get the jobs. They just kind of rotate the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Because there's a new Jurassic Park movie out, that gives me an excuse to channel Dennis Nedry here and say, this concludes the free preview portion of this episode of Numbers and Words. If you want to unlock the rest and get access to every other episode on the Phantom Island feed, go to phantomisland.show and sign up for a paid membership today. Your dollars help support interesting sports discussion and storytelling, not the unethical and dangerous cloning of dinosaurs. I promise.